Hello everyone, welcome to the International Business Podcast. If you work across time zones, borders and cultures, this is the show for you. I'm Leonardo, founder and host of the show, but let's make it simple and just call me Leo. I'm based in Shanghai and I'm accompanied by two co-hosts, Stefano, based in Paris, and Audrey from San Francisco. Coming up on today's episode.
A lot of the headline companies that you see that have quote-unquote failed here, you know, Google, or they'll say even Uber, or they'll say most recently LinkedIn, these companies tend to be B2C companies, consumer technology companies. What I see companies still coming here, and they for sure are still coming here, they're not slowing down at all. If anything, they've increased over the last year, are enterprise B2B companies, and particularly within technology, they're SaaS, software as a service companies. You know, these days, Chinese companies, not just B2C, but B2B as well, have so much of their own IP that they have a huge incentive, and most of the IP cases are between Chinese companies, and they have a huge incentive to make the system work for them.
Art is a senior lawyer advising international businesses in China. He spent the last 15 years working in China to advise technology, manufacturing, and consumer companies on structuring their investments and managing legal risk in their operations. Subscribe to the podcast on your favorite platform, and you can find more details in the show notes. Now let's begin. Hi, Art. I'm glad to have you on. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Audrey. Great to be here.
So, Art, why would you define yourself as an international professional?
That's a good question. You know, I think like any professional here working out of Shanghai, working out of China, has to be aware of what's going on in the world. Shanghai is a very international city, and businesses that come here are used to doing business around the world as well. China is just one of many markets for them, and a very big market, of course. So people like me who are expatriates here, we need to know what's going back in our home country, like the US for me and EU for clients there. I'll give a quick example. You know, a lot of clients in my line of work come here familiar with data privacy laws, and for example, GDPR in Europe. And when they come here in China, last year there was new laws passed on, kind of sweeping new laws passed on data privacy. And their starting point to look at laws in China is what they're familiar with in Europe. So if I'm not familiar with what they're familiar with in Europe, then we're kind of talking past each other. So I think that's true not just for lawyers, I think that's true for all kinds of accountants or finance professionals or other kinds of consultants, advisors. I think you have to know what's going on all over the world to do your job well here.
Well, that's very true. I never actually thought about it through that lens, but it all comes into play when you're working globally. So now you have a deep understanding of the practical difficulties and cultural gaps faced by international headquarters in managing their legal risk in China. What is the number one difficulty foreign companies face?
If I was going to say, pick one thing, I think it's probably not the most obvious thing. It's not necessarily international companies dealing with the risk that China presents by itself, right? It's a lot of times where it shows up is internally. So myself, I have worked inside big companies before here based in Shanghai. And a lot of what you see on the outside is different from what you see on the inside. So a company may announce that it's expanding a lot in China, but you would never have seen all the internal strife in a company, especially a multinational company, to get to that point, and the debates that happen and the conflicts that happen and the push back and forth between a local or regional, let's say a sales team or the leadership team here, who's on the ground and feels that they know the best of what a business should be doing for the strategy, and maybe questioning what the global strategy is as it's applied to China, and also not feeling empowered enough, versus you have the headquarters team, which is really, their starting point is that they're scared of China. They're scared of the risk here. They're scared of the unknowns. They're scared of any, it's human nature to be scared of something that's different, right? So I think because the laws here are not crystal clear, because the government system here is not the same, because they've heard stories about IP theft or a lot of stuff that they've heard in the media, there's a starting point that international headquarters deal has, and there's a starting point that the local team has, which is looking at the upside all around them, you know, opportunities everywhere to grow the business. And so you're always going to have that conflict of a headquarters team that wants to go cautiously and a local team that wants to go full speed ahead.
You work primarily with foreign technology companies coming to China. Most foreign tech companies had given up on trying to succeed there, but let's focus on those who are doing things right. What kind of companies are finding success in China?
Yeah, so for technology companies, let's stick with that. A lot of the headline companies that you that have quote unquote failed here, you know, Google, or they'll say even Uber, or they'll say most recently LinkedIn. These companies tend to be B2C companies, consumer technology companies. What I see companies still coming here, and they for sure are still coming here, they're not slowing down at all. If anything, they've increased over the last year, are enterprise B2B companies, and particularly within technology, they're SaaS, software as a service companies. So they're really trying to take what they've already developed for other markets and localize it here for China. From their perspective, there's a couple of things at work. On the one hand, once you've developed a SaaS, a mature SaaS platform, the cost of expanding it is, you know, the marginal cost of expanding it is very low, like any software business, right? It's the same software for the most part that you use around the world. It's not like you have inventory costs and so forth, or manufacturing costs. That's one thing that pushes software companies to still want to expand, even despite all of the challenges here. The other thing that's important is China is still developing its enterprise SaaS ecosystem here of companies. You know, a lot of people look at Tencent and look at Alibaba and other large companies that are, you know, the internet giants here. And those companies still, for the most part, focus on B2C. And they haven't quite dedicated the resources or gotten it right yet on B2B enterprise software. And that's a real opportunity for American companies in particular to come here. We do see several European companies as well, but for the most part, that's American, you know, software eating the world. That is actually alive and well, and American companies do software better than almost anybody else, because I can say that I'm an American. But that's where the opportunities I'm seeing the most recently.
You've mentioned the term IP quite a bit. So in one or two sentences, can you please define what is IP? What does that term mean?
Yeah, so, well, I can give you sort of the nerdy lawyerly definition, or I can give you what it means to most people and what it means in reality. Technically, if you have intellectual property like copyrights, or trademarks, or patents, it's the right to prevent someone from doing something. It's a technical definition. If I own a patent, for example, it doesn't mean that I have to use the technology that I patent. It doesn't mean that I have to bring the technology and put it in a product and bring that product to market. It just means that I own this technology and no one else can use it. And so I think a lot of people don't think about that part of the equation. In particular, one of the things that also gets overlooked from an IP perspective is trade secrets. So trademarks and copyrights and patents are things you might go out and register somewhere in your home country, in other major markets that you're operating in, including China. And that's helpful to from an enforcement perspective. But one of the things that is really valuable and not talked about enough is the trade secrets, the internal kind of confidential information, that the know-how that makes a business, you know, competitive and have a competitive advantage over another business. And that's where I think a lot of the issues are as well, about companies sometimes hesitating to bring their IP over. It's not so much the code, it's not so much the patents, it's the internal knowledge too that they want to keep close to the chest sometime.
So is IP protection still an issue in China in 2022?
It is definitely a lot better than it used to be. You know, when I got here 15 years ago as a lawyer, I'd spent a couple years in New York and came here because I'd studied the language way back and wanted to do that. You know, but back then there were still, you know, counterfeit knockoffs in, you know, Silk Street in market in Beijing. And so you had all of these kind of, you know, high profile consumer brands being, you know, blatantly kind of ripped off their brands, their labels, their trademarks. You know, these days, Chinese companies, not just B2C, but B2B as well, have so much of their own IP that they have a huge incentive. And most of the, of course, the IP cases are between Chinese companies. And they have a huge incentive to make the system work for them. And when and you know, use the system, go to court, bring, you know, defend their rights, register and defend their rights, whether it's trademarks, copyrights, patents, or other things. And what that does, of course, is that raises the bar for all companies. You know, court here, especially in a first tier city like Shanghai or Beijing or Shenzhen, is not going to take the position, well, okay, if a Chinese company is trying to protect its IP, I'm going to have this kind of analysis of the case. If a foreign company is trying to protect its IP, I'm going to have that kind of analysis case. It doesn't work that way, and no one can do that with a straight face. So these things have happened in other countries as well. Japan, I think, went through this process in the 70s and 80s as well, when Japanese companies started having their own IP to protect. It really improved things across the board. And the courts themselves, the last thing I'll say about that, is the courts themselves are much more sophisticated. The lawyers that become judges are better trained. A lot of them often educated even overseas, so they have kind of an international perspective. And so just the quality of the judges, I think, has gone up quite a bit, and the experience that they have and sophistication of the commercial disputes that they've handled before. So we often, one more point about that. A lot of people, when they're drafting their contracts, will say, you know, well, let's have dispute resolution. You know, if we have any problems with this contract, let's have the court outside of China, or arbitration outside of China. You know, it'll be more fair to us. And I often say, you know, actually, Chinese courts and arbitration are pretty balanced these days, you know, and if anything, I tend to push my clients in the direction of local courts and local arbitration, because it's balanced, and it's much easier to get your judgment enforced here. And so for a lot of ways, it's counterintuitive, but you actually want to have your dispute in an international kind of cross-border contract. You still want your dispute settled here in China.
Wow, that is really interesting.
Yeah, a bit counterintuitive, like I said.
So U.S. laws are made up by endless pages, while China's corporate laws are often short and vague. So as a lawyer educated in the U.S., how do you deal with these two very different systems?
Well, to be honest, that's what makes my job fun. So, you know, I always say, you know, if the laws here were so crystal clear, then it wouldn't be fun to do my job. And so, because for sure, there's a lot more room for interpretation here of the laws. They tend to be very, you know, short on language. A lot of major terms and concepts are not defined. Whereas, as you mentioned, in the US, you know, you're going to have like a congressional record, you're going to have the debate about the different words used in the laws, what the Congress is trying to intend to do by passing the law, what they're trying to cover, what they're not trying to cover. And here you don't have any of that, of course. So what we have to do, when we're trying to decide, you know, does a client need a particular license for their business? Does a client need to have a new policy to comply with this new law? We try to use our experience of how we've seen other laws enforced or not enforced. So I'll give you an example. You know, one of the big issues, again, going back to software companies, when they come here, is this called the value-added telecom service license, which is a family of licenses that software companies often have to wrestle with to decide if they need it when they go up on a local server here in China. And the most common that people may have heard of is called the Internet Content Provider license, the ICP license. And that license is an endless debate for SaaS companies coming here. Do they need it? some people hear that any company that wants to put its software up on a local server, doing that for, you know, getting it inside the great firewall here and speeding up the performance, that they need this license. And that's definitely not true. That's a big misconception. And some people think that they don't need it at all. And that's also not true. So what we try and do is, there is not necessarily a lot in the law itself that explains when it's needed and not. So we call up the regulators, for example. We explain on a no-names basis, this is a situation with this company. They're trying to come here. This is how they're going to set up the business. This is the scope of business they're going to do. You know, this is how the payment processing will work. This is how, this is the target customer. This is the features of the product that are offered. Do you think that they need this license? And surprisingly, the regulators here, that first, it's surprising that they pick up the phone, because you're probably not going to get that in a lot of other places, including the US. Second, they actually tell you what they think for the most part. This didn't used to always be the case. It used to be that regulators had this position of, well, yeah, you're right. The law is not clear. So you're just going to have to apply and then we'll tell you, and which is not helpful, right? So now we find that regulators in these different locations, in Hangzhou, in Beijing, Shanghai, you know, we triangulate different locations. They're much more willing to express their opinion and tell you why, you know, your client may or may not need this license. So that's been greatly appreciated. And then just generally, you know, we try to tell our clients that the regulators here are not going around knocking on every company's door, including every foreign company's door, looking for ways that you're not compliant. Because first, the government here, the regulators here are still very welcome to foreign investment, despite all that's published in the media. And they're just too darn busy. They don't have the time to go look at every software program that's running on a server in China. They're not staffed to do that, nor do they really want to do that. And so where it usually comes up is, you know, let's say a competitor you have that if will flag you and say, you know, to the regulators, say, hey, these guys, check them out. They should be getting this license. We have it. Why don't they have it? But a lot of times our clients are doing things where they don't have local competitors, at least not yet. And that's why they're coming here. That's what I mentioned. They, you know, they're coming here as these B2B SaaS companies because there's no good solution in the market locally. So my long point, and sorry for the long monologue here, but my long point is that we try to explain to them that despite what the law says and what's despite the uncertainty that's built into the law, and despite that that's uncomfortable for you from coming from a US perspective, that you're most likely going to be fine. There's probably a huge business upside case that your business team is pushing you for. And we try and get them comfortable with the idea that the risk is probably not as bad as you think it is.
This episode is sponsored by International Expansion Explained. Are you looking to expand internationally, but you're not sure where to start? Or you export already, but would like to venture further overseas? Reach out to arrange an international clarity session and learn more about growth plans at katherinereed.com. That is katherinreed.com.
And you've mentioned a couple of very strongly held misconceptions that people seem to have about business law in China. So I'm wondering, how do you recommend people learn more about these true and accurate current practices? Is this something that there's a resource for, or is this just something that people learn as time goes on and from personal experiences, such as from yourself?
There's lots of stuff written about this. I have a blog. I'll take the chance to plug my blog.
Of course.
on LinkedIn, China Tech Law newsletter. So I write a lot about these issues. Every 2 weeks, I put out a new edition. There's lots of other, you know, law firms, including our firm, will put out kind of client alerts talking about these things, podcasts. You know, if you search around enough, you'd be surprised. You can get a decent sense of what's going on. At the end of the day, you probably, of course, can't rely on that to make a business decision. You really need to hire an advisor. But, you know, you really need to educate yourself. The more you can educate yourself before you decide to come here and familiar with these issues,
then the faster you're going to be able to wrap your head around it. And when you finally do engage an advisor and even filter what the advisor is telling you based on what else you've read out there. So definitely there are resources out there that for people to educate themselves.
So I'm going to switch it up and get a little bit more personal. So can you tell us, did you always want to be a lawyer?
No, definitely not.
That was quick.
I, like a lot of people, some will admit it, some will not admit it. Like a lot of people went to law school because I didn't know what else to do. And so I was in China. I had studied Chinese in university, the language, and also kind of like the economy and history of the place here and so forth. And then when I graduated, I kept going with the language. I studied another year in Beijing at university, and I still didn't know what I wanted to do. So I kept kind of kicking the can down the road. And finally, I just said, well, I've got this liberal arts degree. My dad's a lawyer. So I talked with him and he's like, yeah, you might like law school. And I was like, okay, fine. I might like law school. Let's do it. I got about halfway through law school and I realized I probably didn't really like it that much, maybe even quicker than that. But I learned to like it over the years. But for sure, I think when I was in law school, I don't know if you know much about it. I mean, it's 3 years. It's too long. You know, by the time your third year, you're like, can I please get out and try and do something practical instead of reading all of these cases, which are, you know, 100 years old. So I think there's a bit of frustration there with the way law is taught in the US. But you know, even that has grown on me over the years. You know, now I appreciate it a lot more, the theory that they teach you, because when you're a lawyer, you really have to be a problem solver and you really have to think about how to analyze a problem. And law school teaches you the mechanics of that very well. That's the one thing I think it does teach you very well. So that's a useful tool. But no, I did not want to be a lawyer when I was going in after about halfway through and then coming out, but it grew on me.
I appreciate your honesty.
I definitely like it now. I do like it now, but it was when you're out of law school, you know, you have to, you like me, you have, you know, over $100,000 of loans. I don't even know what it would cost now. You have no choice but to work at a big law firm where they just work you to death. I was in New York, and you know, after school, after graduating for a year and a half, and it's just a tough life. You know, it's a tough life. The hours, the unpredictability of it. That you're paid very well, so you can't complain, and I can't complain. It's just to pay off your school loans, like I said. But it's that first part that you really have, first stage of coming out of law school for most lawyers, I think they have to get through, you know, kind of paying their dues. And then after that, I think it grows on them more.
So Art, over all of your years working in multiple companies, multiple countries, who has been your most important professional mentor?
I'd have to say probably the partner that I worked with the most at the firm when I first came to China. So I'll name him. He's a good friend, Paul McKenzie. He's still at my old firm, Morrison Forrester. So when I came over in 2007 to China, I was hired by a different partner who was a great guy, but after a year he went, he joined a company instead of staying at the firm. So I was kind of an orphaned associate at the firm, but Paul really took me under his wing, had a lot of patience to teach good writing skills, good ways of interacting with the client, trying to put yourself in the shoes of the client and what is easier, a way to write things, explain things that's easier for them to understand and kind of predict the problems that they're thinking about for them. And also just how to balance your life with your work life, with your personal life. I thought he was always very good at that. And so I just really appreciate, and I'm still good friends with him. And when we talk, you know, every few months or so to this day, even though that was over, 13 years ago that I left the firm there. So Paul McKenzie for sure.
Okay, I've got one final question I ask everyone who comes on the show. Can you tell us about one memorable moment from your international career? The most successful, the funniest, the most catastrophic episode, your pick?
You know, I don't know if it's which of those categories it fits into. It's not a story I've told often, so I'll try and mix it up a bit. And it's not necessarily international, but it is a story about being a lawyer. So, you know, it's picking up on that talking about working in New York. So, when you're that you know, first or second junior associate right out of law school, you're like me, and you're working on these big M&A deals, and you're kind of on these big teams, and everything is very stressful. You know, one of the hardest parts as a lawyer is to always be perfect, or feel like you always need to be perfect and can never make mistakes. And there's kind of internally, you know, other lawyers that you work with at the firm are obviously a lot less tolerant. They have high expectations that they want to deliver for the client, and your clients are paying you a lot of money, so they don't ever want to see a mistake either. But we had one mistake, one which in retrospect was not that big of a mistake, but my gosh, was it a full-blown crisis when it happened. So we had this large M&A deal. As part of the closing process for that deal, we had to put what's called a funds flow memo together to just show all the different, you know, there was 100 different kind of private equity funds that were investing into the deal. And they had to say, list their bank accounts, the amounts that they were contributing to the investment, all that kind of stuff. And the client was very careful to make sure that the investors, that investor A did not know who investor B was, and investor C, they all was all anonymous. And lo and behold, we screwed that up. You know, a task like that, as you can imagine, gets delegated to a very junior lawyer because it's a very menial task, right? You're just kind of managing spreadsheets and Word documents and bank account numbers and so forth. But we screwed it up because we were exhausted, and we'd been working 20 hours a day for weeks on end. And so we had myself and another person were on top of it, supposedly. And I thought he was doing one thing, he thought I was doing another thing. And the wrong file went out to a few of the investors, and they told the client, of course, immediately called our lead partner on the deal, and we got an earful for it. The point of the story is that my fellow associate and I kind of had to go down and do a mea culpa to the lead partner, and he had to, you know, explain it all. And I think just the fear in our, you know, of us for something which, again, was not that big of a deal. You know, it was full blown crisis. The lawyers, the lead managing relationship partner was on the call back and forth. People were getting, you know, angry. How could this happen? And I just, even as a 27 year old, I was just thinking, is this really that big of a deal? You know, like the client, even the person that got the wrong information just said, hey, by the way, I got this information. You probably shouldn't let other people see this. But in, you know, everyone else was freaking out. And that's also just gave me a lot of perspective. You know, you can't kill yourself trying to be perfect at your job. You can't kill yourself trying to be perfect as a lawyer, whatever you do, because you know what? Life goes on. And you can't beat yourself up too much. I mean, I just remember that other associate and I, we were just terrified that, you know, we were going to get fired, that how are we going to explain this to the partner? How did we screw up? And then just looking back, even like 6 months later, I was like, why did I care so much? Why did I get so worried? You know, nobody remembers it. So I think that's just the perspective of a story where, you know, when you're in the moment doing a job as a lawyer, whatever, you know, don't get too stressed about one particular thing, because, you know, it's usually not as big of a deal as you think it is.
So Art, before we go, who should connect with you and tell us a bit more about your current role?
Sure. I think, for the most part, I focus on technology companies, like I said. So we have clients who are 3D printing companies here with their solution, a lot of software companies. Myself, my own background was in semiconductor before coming back to private practice here. So, you know, those are the bread and butter clients that I have, but I also service B2C companies as well. You know, you tend to, over the years, you'd learn a lot of different industries here. So it's more about the experience of the lawyer in dealing with the uncertainty that we all talked about before. Our clients tend to be medium-sized companies. So often it is, I mean, of course, big clients, you know, global multinational companies like IBM are welcome as well. But what we really try and focus on are those clients that don't have any legal support here locally in country. So a lot of those big companies, those IBMs of the world, they'll have a big local legal team that they can rely on. What we do is we kind of operate as their local counsel for them internally, including we work directly with their business teams on the ground here sometimes. And so we're kind of like your local in-house counsel for China. So usually those companies are maybe late stage funding before their IPO, maybe shortly after IPO, their investors push them to come to China as part of the IPO story and the upside for growing their business. So that's usually the stage we see companies at, that kind of pre-IPO and just shortly after the IPO stage. But of course, we welcome all clients, whatever stage they're at, but that's what we see the most.
Well, Art, I want to thank you for your insights and thank you for joining us on the International Business Podcast.
Yes, thank you, Audrey, for having me. It's really been a pleasure to join, and thank you for the opportunity.
You can find the podcast on all the major platforms. Make sure to subscribe. Do not miss the weekly episodes. And are you an international professional? Connect with us on LinkedIn to come on the show. For now, cheers.